Welcome back to the Teaching in Tech podcast for Season 3 with Alan and Chad, where we continue to explore everything related to teaching, learning, and technology integration. Working with teachers, we see amazing things happening in classrooms every day. In each episode, we'll detail teaching strategies and technology integration ideas that are working. Also, special guests will join us to share strategies that have been successful with students.
Well, welcome back to episode 2. Unfortunately, we do not have Mr. Hoffman here with us today, but in the interview process, we do have the Dr. Literacy, Lynn Rudd.
Hello, hello. Thank you for using my formal title, Mr. Brown.
Absolutely. Hey, so I appreciate you coming in and joining us today. Those that are out there, Lynn is our literacy lead here in Kansas City. She works with secondary literacy and our new teachers, but I want to go ahead and give her the opportunity to introduce herself.
Well, thank you. And I'm excited to be here. And this is one of my favorite places in at McKinley High School and my favorite human. So thank you for this invitation. So a little bit about me. I am the product of two women graduating from college before me. So I'm a third generation college graduate on the female side of my family. So I'm very proud of that. My grandmother and my mother were both teachers. And so I was on that track early in life, except I broke with tradition and got a degree in 7 through 12 English as opposed to elementary. So I started off being an English teacher for my career, but through a variety of circumstances, I ended up working in a reading clinic and getting my master's degree in reading endorsement and my specialist education. And I went back in the classroom for a while. I've always loved reading. I've always enjoyed literacy. And it was after I got my master's and specialist degree that I started really reading research on adolescent literacy and just fueling my passion for that, because it was a rather overlooked topic, because most of the conversations about literacy focuses on K-3 or even K-6. So I kind of found my place there. When we moved to Canton, I taught at Malone University, and actually we had a partnership with Canton City Schools, and where I taught my class at the Timken campus downtown. So I got to know the Timken campus, the teachers. I just loved it there. And eventually, after a few years of doing that, I was able to work at Timken through a grant funded position as a literacy coach, instructional coach. And then I became a diehard CCSD teacher, working with adolescents, supporting teachers, researching how to help students read, write, and think more effectively and successfully. That also fueled my desire to get more education. So I went back and was able to obtain my PhD. I've had a chance to teach full-time in college at Walsh University, but I came back to CCSD, and I just really love adjuncting, but spending my time here in CCSD and helping to support teachers and the amazing work that they do every day here. So that's a little bit about me and the background that I bring to the table.
Wow, definitely appreciate that. You really have a rich history, particularly that with literacy, which, you know, hence the name Dr. Literacy. But that's really a big piece that we want to talk about today for those listening. And, you know, some of the strategies on engaging students, particularly with content literacy, and no one better than Lynn really has some of those strategies to share. So Lynn, as you know, as we go through when we started talking, you know, disciplinary literacy being a primary focus here in Kansas City, particularly at the high school, there's a few strategies that you were kind of outlining with me on getting kids engaged in discussion. Do you mind starting with the questioning piece that you've discussed?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I'd like to point out that when reading research, and the Ohio's Plan for Raising Literacy Achievement actually talks about this, the five fundamentals of reading are phonemic awareness, phonics, fluency, vocabulary, and comprehension. However, when students move into adolescence, probably 12 or 13 through 18, kind of the concepts change a little bit, or they call it the big ideas of adolescent literacy. And in that concept, the idea of motivation is added, because we know that reading and the success in reading and literacy for adolescents is very deeply tied to motivation. So I say all that because one of the things that I talk to teachers a lot about is how can we motivate student to be engaged with the content of the classrooms? Because that is a very key foundational piece. Obviously, they still need fluency practice. They still need vocabulary. They still need comprehension strategies. But ultimately, we need to help them be motivated. So one way I think we can invite more students into being motivated and owning what we're teaching them is to involve them in more discussion. Most of the time you can walk through a high school, not just McKinley High School, but almost any high school, and the person doing most of the talking, or the people doing most of the talking, will be the teachers, not the students. And that isn't a way to motivate the students. That's not a way to make them, help them own the information. So discussion is very, very important. And one, you know, good teaching, people talk about teaching being both a science and an art, right? About 90% of what makes a great teacher is actually a science, things that we know to be true, like making a safe environment, differentiating instruction, scaffolding, understanding zones of proximal development, all of those things. That's the science of being a great teacher. But about 10% is really just tweaking or using your personality or understanding each of your students in a different way from year to year or content to content. And so sometimes it's not a huge revolutionary change that you that could be made for a teacher to become even more effective with students. And one simple strategy to encourage them to discuss more is just changing the question. For example, oftentimes, and I'm in meetings and like I hear this happen all the time in my adult world, there will be a conversation or a teaching part, and then the person in charge will say, "Does anyone have any questions?" And you know, some of us, if it's gone for a long time, this meeting, we're like, "No, no, no one has any questions," right? Because we want to go home. Usually, typically, in a group of adolescents, very seldom are they going to jump up and say, "Well, I have a question," both because, you know, for a lot of different reasons. But if we just change that question and we say, instead of, "Does anyone have any questions?" we change it to, "What questions do you have?" or "What are your questions?" Just that simple turn of the phrase shows an expectation that the students will have questions and an expectation that they want to engage with the material and become more informed about it. And it just opens up the floor, I think, in a really positive way. So it's just a simple strategy of that. The art of teaching is just changing the question.
Yeah, I think oftentimes we think that questions need to be directly related to what we're asking, or like the way we're framing questions, we've got a specific answer that we want to get out of kids. But one, not to deviate from what you're saying, you know, a little bit more open or reframed allows students to kind of have their own perception or thought in the response, which in this particular case would allow them to have their own thought or perception in the response of the question. I really love the idea of, you know, how you're flipping it, because kids are smart. You know, intuitively they pick things up more so than we would realize. And when we say, you know, "What are your questions?" it just flips it on saying, you know, "I know you have a question. I just need you to ask it."
Right. And it allows the teacher to maybe understand where some conceptual difficulties are in the students, or even the students to say, oh, maybe I'm not as far from understanding this as I thought I was. Because, and so again, that allows them to own the question, that allows them to own the pronunciation and using the words and the concepts within the question. So it just is a very empowering kind of invitation, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. And really that, you know, getting kids engaged, you really have to have that invitation. And if kids don't feel like it is that open invitation, or that it's, you know, it's a very isolated setting and the teacher's the one that has all the knowledge and provides all the knowledge, you lose that motivation factor and you lose that student engagement, which, as you just said, is one of the five components of adolescent literacy.
Right. And it also, I mean, one of the things I tried to do a lot within my classroom when I was teaching is I talked about our room as a community of learners. And I tried to constantly encourage that everybody was a learner, including me. So this is another way I think it opens up the floor or opens up the opportunities for those adolescents to say, okay, I'm learning here, and actually my questions can help other students understand, or even my teacher, to make it make more sense for us because we're all in the community together, through just a simple change of a framing question.
Yeah, I think that's great, especially, you know, it comes back to the point where you said sometimes it doesn't need to be a major change in order to have a large impact.
Absolutely.
And so I'd love to move into our next strategy that you were discussing, an anticipation guide. You know, for some of our listeners not really knowing maybe what that is, or really how to implement it, and then what are the benefits of using an anticipation guide in class?
Okay. The anticipation guide is one of my favorite tools, resources. This would be more of a content area reading tool as opposed to a disciplinary literacy tool. You can certainly use it in any content area classroom. An anticipation guide usually, classically, looks like a table with three columns and a statement about the concepts or about what you're teaching go in the middle. So for instance, if you were doing an anticipation guide on the Civil War, one of the statements might be the Civil War began only because of slavery. And the students on the right hand side, because there are three columns, on the right or the left column, they might have agree, and then they would check if they agree with that. And then all the way on the other side of the concept, the third column, they would check if they disagreed with that or not. So if they're anticipating what they know about the statements. So it allows for a lot of different things. First of all, it gives the teacher data on what background information or what misconceived ideas or what understandings already exist. So if, you know, a social studies teacher is asking this question and everybody in the room agrees that the Civil War was only fought because of slavery, you know, that teacher will know, well, there's also a lot of economics involved and a lot of other things that were involved in the Civil War. So that teacher automatically then knows the work that needs to be done. In other ways, it gets into schema theory, which I don't want to put everyone to sleep here when I talk about theory, but schema theory is, you know, we have to have anchors, if you will, if I can borrow Mr. Anderson's terminology, we have to have anchors to put new learning onto, or hooks. So schema theory says we have to open up or allow the schemas to be, you're basically your brain ready to accept new knowledge. So the anticipation guide opens up, for instance, in our example, the schema of the Civil War. And it also then gives hooks for the students to say what were the causes of the Civil War. And that schema is just a connection in the brain about how all these things make sense together. So those are the different reasons that you would use an anticipation guide before you really get into the content. Now, I love the anticipation guide. You use it throughout the lesson, for example, or the unit. So you start off with that, but maybe midway through the unit, you go back to it and you ask your students to change what they thought or not. And then maybe even add a little piece to say, now turn to your partner, which goes back to discussion. Why did you change? Why did you move from agree to disagree? Again, because we're talking about how to have kids own their learning and be motivated, they both have the safety of having the words and the concepts and the background knowledge now from part of the information they've been taught from the unit. Then they can turn to their peers and actually talk through that using vocabulary, using their understanding, kind of owning why their thinking has changed and interact about that. So that just deepens the understanding of the content and the concepts that they're learning. And then again, go back to the anticipation guide at the end of a unit and do the same kind of activity. It's less about the teacher just teaching or lecturing or giving the information and then students taking a test, and more about what did you think before? What were you thinking during? And then what do you think now? It really helps them track their learning. It really helps them see that they're growing. And ultimately, hopefully, it would build confidence in them as learners.
Yeah, you know, as you keep talking about it, I keep thinking how this is, it doesn't seem like it would take a lot of time to implement something like this.
Right, not at all.
Yeah, and the impact, and I love the idea of cycling back. So at the beginning of a lesson, I mean, that's a quick way to just as an intro, you know, what do you already know? And we've quoted David Anderson many times with his anger points here. But it is very easy. Like when we talk about implementing either a new strategy or refining one, it does come back to engaging prior knowledge. And, mm-hmm. and I think in this case, it's a very explicit way to do it, because you're saying, what do you already know? And you're not asking them that, but you're saying, what do you know? And how does it connect to what we're about to talk about? And it's just a simple, like you said, agree or disagree, and really layering why and rationalizing our thinking. And I love the idea of coming back to it and allowing them to reflect. And if they didn't change their mind, why do you not change your mind on this case? Why do you feel like you're still right? And, you know, rationalize it to your partner. And are you in agreement with your partner? Can you rationalize, you know, why you're in agreement or disagreement? And just adding that layer of discussion and really allowing kids, like, you know, our goal is to provide them with a wealth of knowledge and a full, well-rounded understanding of the world that they live in, and allowing them to really develop who they are as people. And if we don't give them a chance to discuss or think critically, we're really doing a disservice.
Absolutely. And it also, in the anticipation guide, it assumes they already have knowledge, which I think is also very invitational. Like you're saying, I know you know something here. Even if you don't recognize these terms, what are some thoughts you have about it? Maybe if you just heard it. It assumes knowledge. It doesn't assume that they're blank slates. Now I'm going to turn it back to you, Mr. Brown. I've given an example of what it would look like in social studies, but I think it could really work in the math class. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, and I'm thinking basic practice. When we talk about, you know, our state tests and some of the preparation there in algebra, there's some questions on there that are already pre-solved, and it's having kids pretty much analyze if there's an error or not. And to me, this could be a very simple application of that, of having the kids, was it solved correctly? Yes or no, agree or disagree. Mm-hmm. And then we go into the lesson. You know, when you start getting to some of the higher level math that does apply a little bit more theory, it could really have the kid try and dive in on the application of theory. When you start talking about postulates and theorems in mm-hmm. geometry, mm-hmm. You start talking about limits in calculus, you know, really getting kids, it just kind of, it's a broader scope in which they're looking at it. And then I think it takes away maybe the fear of them being wrong on the answer, because they're not the ones solving it initially. They're just saying, do you agree with it being correct or incorrect? And then from there, the teacher can teach or review it. And then the kid can go back, oh man, I was wrong because I thought this, or I was right because this is actually true and I knew it.
Yeah, that's great. And it also allows them to see that multiple strategies can be used in solving problems.
Yeah, too often, I think, in particularly math, you know, but across the board, really, some students really feel like if it's not the teacher's way, it's the wrong way. And, right. and I don't think it's because our teachers are saying that. Our teachers are showing a way that they know how to get it, but students then take away, you know, their own ability to critically think a different path to get to the same answer. And sometimes, you know, we know it's a very linear path. There's only one way, but there's how many times in life is there really only one way to get somewhere?
Absolutely.
And so allowing kids to kind of think through, oh, I was right. You know, I got the same answer, but I went this way because I thought this.
Absolutely. And I love that. And just think about the opportunities that would be in a math class for students to gain confidence. If, like you said, it's not a right or wrong to solve it, but a right or wrong, is this answer correct? And then you could even try to postulate why or explain why. Yeah, that's great.
As I say, in math, we tend to, and now you're going to get me down a rabbit hole of math, right? But you know, kids tend to not start a problem because they don't have confidence in their ability to finish it. And in this case, it allows them, everybody's got an opinion, right? And if it's, binary, one or the other, then kids are more likely going to respond to at least start the engagement piece and then build from there. And I really think, you know, as we're talking through this, the application of an anticipation guide is limitless when you look across the board in any content.
Absolutely. Okay, can I move on to the last strategy? I'm going to keep you from going into your rabbit hole of math. This is my interview.
Absolutely. Please lead us into your passion of morphology and root words.
Actually, this is just as important for math teachers as it is for ELA, although it's not often seen as the place where all other content areas can help. Okay, so a morpheme is basically the smallest meaningful part of a word. So that's what a morpheme is. Like, for instance, adding even an S to the word apple, if you put an S to it, that changes the word a little bit. It makes it plural. So even an S can be a morpheme. So understanding morpheme or morphology is helping students and yourself understand what words mean by breaking down the meaningful parts. So that sounds a bit academic, but it's really not. And I think if teachers of other contents could really wrap their head around this, they could actually be more proficient at helping students with vocabulary than even English teachers. And this is why. When English teachers teach a novel, they have to choose some of their vocabulary a little bit in an incidental way, because conceptually, you know, novels aren't written to be conceptual. They're written to be stories. So you pick out words that apply to the main characters or the time period or that are important to understand in the setting. But those words aren't necessarily highly connected to English as a content area. They're important to that book, but in English class, it's just really different when you talk about vocabulary. However, in any science class or in many, many social studies classes, many other content areas, if you can really teach students the key morphemes of your content area, it's going to empower them to be able to break down words they don't understand and gain a lot of confidence to figure it out. For example, shun, T-I-O-N, is a very important suffix in social studies world. Why? Because shun means the state of. So anytime a student gets any word that has shun at the end, at least they know, well, this is the state of something. In keeping with our Civil War theme, emancipation, that's a big word, lots of syllables. I know many students, high school students, would read that and say, I don't even know what that means. But if they could take the shun away and say, okay, this is the state of something. Oh, wait, emancipate. Oh, the state of being emancipated. What does emancipated mean? And again, even if they don't know what emancipated means, if they connect it to the Civil War and they're, oh, slavery, maybe it means something about freeing slaves. Like, they're putting things together simply by using their morphology understanding. Again, the Greek and Latin suffix, prefixes, and even roots for science. Many of us probably did learn try and by and, you know, those things. That is morphology as well. And math, the different content areas, many different morphemes can be taught so that students can break it down, break new words down to be able to understand the content. So again, it's a way to empower students and be motivated to figure these things out on their own. And again, so you have a vocabulary lesson, you have a new vocabulary word at the board, but they have had some morphology training. So you say, you know, with your shoulder partner and in a small group, figure out what the definition is for this word by taking it into its parts. And so students figure that out. They don't necessarily have to open a dictionary, and they use their own words and their own understanding of the parts to figure out the definition. So I really feel like that is another way to encourage discussion and really to be positively influencing your vocabulary instruction, and also just giving students tools to be successful in the future.
Yeah, I think that's great. When you look at tier two, tier three vocabulary across the board, and really understanding that the roots are what create, yes, a lot of these words. And I'm just thinking back to math, right? And obviously,
that's all right. You can.
I just can't help myself.
I know.
I think that was a very okay. I'm going back. I'm looking, you know, start from the beginning where you talk about why there's probably a conflict between ELA and other contents, mm-hmm, and never really thought about how ELA comes across their terms or their vocab. And it's really based on what they find as being an important word at the time, or right, maybe a difficult word that a student needs help with understanding, where the other ones become content specific tier three words. And that may have a specific morphology or root that we can identify and then build from there.
Right. Absolutely.
And I think what's interesting when you go down this rabbit hole is the cross between different classes, mm-hmm, and maybe the different meanings of different types of words.
Yes. Polysemy.
Thank you. I did forget about it. Don't let Josh know.
I won't. It'll be our secret.
but when students can start to break down what the words mean and understand the different roots and the morphological meanings of the words, I mean, and then they draw in their own context and their own background thinking, it then allows them to almost become more independent within the class, which, right, I would say increases student engagement and motivation, because now you have intrinsic success and motivators to not only be, you know, understand more, but because you know more.
Absolutely. Right. And we know everyone, adults or adolescents, when they feel confident, they will be able to learn more because they'll be able to risk more. And all learning comes from some type of disequilibrium. You don't learn without feeling a little bit of dissonance. That's just the nature of what learning is. And if students don't feel confident or safe enough to go into that disequilibrium, they're really never going to learn well and deeply.
Well, I mean, you know, bringing up our wit and wisdom adoption when we had that, you know, and they talk about productive struggle,
Yes.
And finding that balance between where it's really challenging versus really easy. And, you know, that line where you're not going to quite give up because you can do it and you know you can do it, but it's definitely harder than what you're used to.
Absolutely. Yeah. I love that phrase too.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the three strategies, Lynn, but, you know, as we're wrapping up, I just want to ask, you know, normally what we ask some of our interviewees, what is a piece of advice you'd give to maybe a new teacher that's coming in that's struggling with some student motivation or engagement, or maybe a veteran teacher that's really looking to kind of revamp some of their instructional approach?
Well, I think I would try to take my own advice and ask a question back to a teacher. And I would say, who is doing the work? As far as who is doing the cognitive load of the classroom learning? You know, secondary schools especially were built on the idea that teachers have the wise understandings. They have the wisdom. They've learned from books that are hard to come by, like not everybody has. And then it was necessary for the teacher to share that information to the students. That's not really the world that we live in right now. Our students have access to any kind of knowledge, and certainly all the knowledge that we had when we went to college, even if it was 2 years ago, like they could access that. Now, again, I understand that accessing information on TikTok is not accessing information from a textbook you had in college. I'm not equating the two. However, they do equate the two. They'll pull information from lots of different places and think that it's learning, which it is, I guess, in technical terms. But we just don't live in the world where one person in the room has all the knowledge, because everybody has access to the knowledge at their fingertips all the time, even if you have a Yonder bag, because you have an iPad. Right?
Oh, no.
No, we won't go on that train, that rabbit hole. So teachers need to let students be the center of classrooms. And I'm not saying so that all craziness and chaos can break out. I mean, so that they can be part of the drivers of the learning, that they can own it, that they can be motivated. They can find and seek information. They need guides. And I'm trying to stay away from the classic sage on the stage versus guide on the side, but there's a reason why it works. We need to be more of the guides on the side. And yes, as guides, we have studied these things for longer. Even the brand new teacher has studied his or her content area much more than the teenagers in the classroom. However, that does not mean that their background knowledge doesn't bring, or experiences bring, more information to their understanding than the teacher really even ever thought of. Teachers' knowledge bases can be extended as well. Schemas of teachers can be expanded and made more in depth and more deeper. Oh, more deeper. That's terrible. Can be made deeper.
Oh, no. Here we go.
Oh, no. So who's doing the work? Is it teacher-centered, with the teacher doing all the work, all the talking, all the communication, all the thinking? Or are students doing the work? Are the students doing the lifting of the learning and the thinking and the conversation and the owning of the information? So I would probably just start off there and then talk about tools or strategies or resources to help that shift, help that teacher shift into more student-centered classroom learning.
No, I think that's great advice. You know, I reflect back on when I was in the classroom, and when I kind of let go of some control, my students just had a different feel or a different vibe in class. You know, they were engaged. They weren't afraid to ask questions. You know, we talk about state standards and the high stakes of courses, but I also wasn't afraid to deviate a little bit and maybe say, you know what, let's kind of explore that. Or I don't necessarily know the answer right now. Let's figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And you just be surprised on how your kids engage at that point. So when it was said, all right, it's time to buckle down and look at this, they would.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. And actually just last week, I was in a classroom with a brand new teacher and students were asking questions about the election results. And they were asking really specific questions about things they didn't understand. And even the teacher said, I don't know. I'm going to have to read some policy about that topic tonight. And actually he came in that day saying, okay, these were your questions yesterday. I took time last night and I read some different policies. I went to the places where I know I can trust. And here's what I know to be true at this time. And I was just so impressed. And I told him what a great model, because the students were bringing their own questions and they were tuned in and locked into his explanation because he had gone and done the work on their questions. But he also modeled being a learner. And again, the questions themselves weren't on the state test, but he tied it into, and this is the right of that you find in Amendment 10. Or then he talked about how it did relate to what we would think of as the state standards or what's on the test. So it was a beautiful illustration, a little bit of what you were talking about as well.
Well, it's making every moment a teaching moment at that point, and not, yes, you know, not being afraid to tie it back to what you're really trying to make as your objective, but allowing kids to have that freedom.
Right. Absolutely. It was very impressive.
Well, I appreciate your time today, Lynn. You know, I hope everybody enjoyed the conversation and the insight that Lynn can share, even though that was just a brief glimpse. But at least if you could have taken one of the strategies that you can take back to your classroom, like I've always said, is just take a risk. And if you've enjoyed the podcast, please remember to subscribe, rate, and write us a review. You can find all episodes of Teaching in Tech with Alan and Chad on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.